history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not remain untold. But they will, unless we take the time to ask a few questions and then listen patiently and attentively to what some of our most experienced Americans have to say. The goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and in the process, it's amazing what we end up learning. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by what we have the privilege of hearing here on Hometown Heroes. One of the things I haven't done the best job of is keeping you updated when significant things happen in the lives of veterans after they've shared their stories on the radio with us, but I do have the chance to do that today, and it's a reminder that even in times as bleak and trying as the last few months have been for America and for the world, we can always find silver linings if we're looking for them. For many of us, the COVID-19 era has resulted in a slower pace or an opportunity to catch up on or complete projects we always said, if I ever get enough time, I'll finish this or that. When you're an award-winning filmmaker who all of a sudden has to hit the brakes on new shoots, you get to go back and finish that labor of love you started years ago. And that's what Cameron Mitchell experienced in completing the documentary Flight Path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. It tells the story of legendary test pilot Don Malik, whose many contributions included a very significant contribution to the eventual landing on the moon. When Don shared his story on Hometown Heroes in 2018, we learned that the service of his father and uncle in World War I and his older brother's time as a bomber pilot in World War II inspired his own quest to become a Navy fighter pilot and then a true pioneer as someone willing to fly aircraft that had never been flown before. At hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to that original interview and also to the trailer for the new documentary. I think you'll really be intrigued by watching it. And here on the radio, I can at least let you listen to it before we catch up with Mr. Malik and Cameron Mitchell, the man who has captured his story on film. Here's part of that trailer with portions of it shot on location at Edwards Air Force Base in California's Mojave Desert.
This is the home of test pilot school. This is the home of flight test for the entire nation and much of the Western world.
NASA benefits tremendously from our test pilot and research pilots. The skill set they bring to the table is another set of eyes and ears from their perspective. As much as you want to plan and design a test and a research program, it's not until you actually get in the plane and fly it that you have that real feedback.
Then there are the experimental aircraft that nobody else has, and that requires pilots who are able to make the adjustment to something that has never flown before, that no one has ever flown before, and for which you can only create a simulator on the assumption of certain flight parameters. So let's take Don Malik, for instance.
In Don Malik's case, he has flown more aircraft than most of us could probably even name. And having the skill set to adapt from one plane to the next, sometimes within the same week, is very difficult to do.
I had a little over 11,000 hours flying and 125 different types of helicopters and airplanes combined.
To become a test pilot, you have to compete. So you're competing against the best there is. I'm trying not to be a smart aleck. How do you know there's a test pilot in a room? He'll tell you.
The work that Don Malik did and the rest of the team on the lunar landing research vehicle was critical to the Apollo landing.
They flew a machine that had never flown before. They flew it, a machine that nobody really thought could fly. It was ungainly, it was awkward, it was bizarre.
The first flight, Neil Armstrong not only ran out of thrusting propellant, but he ran out of attitude propellant, and the vehicle went out of control.
He had to eject, and the parachute opened up just in time for him to touch the ground and survive. He went back to his office and went to work. A little while later, one of his colleagues walked through the office and saw him and said, "Hey, Neil, I just heard the funniest story. I heard you ejected from the LLRV about an hour ago." And Neil said, "Yeah, sure." And he just couldn't believe that he just got back up and went to work.
From the time I was 12, I always wanted to fly. Flying and being a contributor to the lunar mission meant everything to me.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, as I stand out here in the wonders of the unknown at Hadley, I try to realize there's a fundamental truth to our nature. Man must explore.
Risk is the price of progress. That is the history of the experimental rocket program here at Dryden.
Roger, understand. We're number one on the runway.
Two roads diverged in a woods, and I took one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Again, that's the trailer for the just-completed documentary, Flight Path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. And on the line now, we have both the subject of the film, 89-year-old Don Malik of Lancaster, California, as well as the filmmaker, Emmy Award winner Cameron Mitchell. They first met many years ago when Cameron accompanied the late, great Huell Howser to Edwards to shoot an episode of the esteemed TV series California's Gold. It focused on the LLRV, the Lunar Lander Research Vehicle, and its irreplaceable role in the development of the lunar excursion module that Neil Armstrong would land on the surface of the moon in 1969. Cameron was so struck by Don Malik and his life story that he decided someday he would try to capture that story in film.
Well, the first phase, you know, we kind of were moving along slowly, and we had created together the documentary short called Risk is the Price of Progress, the story of the LLRV. And that was entered in a number of film festivals around the state and different places, and garnered some accolades, if I recall. It did well in probably about three or four different film festivals. And so that was kind of the base, the ground floor to moving on to a flight path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. So it's been a long trip, and Don stuck by me through the whole process, and he was constantly referring me to different people to interview, and the folks at NASA had been super fantastic over there. But so that was the start of it, the documentary short, and I had always wanted to do a full-length feature on Don, kind of giving the whole encapsulation of Don's life from his beginnings in aviation and all the way up to the grand finale.
I think an important part of it, too, was, Cameron, where you were able to include a number of the other NASA people that were involved in a lot of those developments and everything. I was just one call going to gear that did a lot of that work, and I think when you integrated the others in together, it really made a strong story. You kept at it, and I think you did a super job.
What was it about Don? Because, you know, working with Huell Howser, who we all remember so well, and I'm glad, you know, Don forgave him for being a Marine, but working with him, I'm sure you met a lot of interesting people in a lot of places. So what was it about Don and his story and his life that grabbed you the way it did?
Oh, my goodness, there was so many. The more, as I got to know Don over the years and, you know, doing interviews and things with him, I found out that he came from a multi-generational military family. His father and one of his uncles served, and his brother was a bomber pilot in World War II who was a decorated pilot. And then ever since Don was a little boy growing up in Pennsylvania, Don kind of got the idea in his head he wanted to be a pilot too. So we follow this story, you know, all the way from his childhood. And I think just all the amazing accomplishments Don made with the XB-70, the M2F1, the lifting body plane, the Blackbird SR-1, and the YF-12, I think it was Don. And it just had such an amazing history to his flying days with NASA. And I said, this guy's story's got to be told. I mean, he's the guy behind the curtain that you never hear about, but he contributed to one of the most major accomplishments in NASA history by, you know, developing and working with the LLRV to get the guys to the moon.
Well, you just kind of hit on it. There are so many people that get attention, and most of the general public knows bits and pieces. You know, they can tell you that Neil Armstrong was the first on the moon, and they can tell you maybe the other astronauts on that mission. Most of them haven't heard of the LLRV, and most of them never think of things in terms of test pilots and everything that they risk and everything that they have to master. For people who get the chance to watch this documentary, What are the important things that you hope they learn from the story you're trying to tell?
I'd say the biggest thing is that it takes a very, very special, unique individual to commit their life to the aviation and to this, you know, type of career, because you have to have, Don can tell you, you know, strong engineering background, and, you know, a lot of the pilots do come from, you know, military backgrounds. And it's just that real tenacity, of boldness, and intelligence, and just a love of flight, and their willingness to, you know, go out there and say, okay, this plane or this strange vehicle like the Lunar Land Research Vehicle has never been tested before, but I'm going to get in this thing and use my wits and my experience to learn how to fly this and, you know, contribute to aviation and moving these types of projects forward. I'm sure Don could tell you a couple of exciting stories about the LLRV and some of his first flights.
You know, and Don, I ran into a guy the other day, was introduced to someone, and he's one of those, I know there are a few of them out there, who hold to this belief that the lunar landing was somehow staged, that it didn't really happen. And I said, well, you know, I've met a few people who were part of it, including a guy who had to not only test the lunar lander research vehicle, but he had to put it together like something you order from IKEA or Home Depot. And I was just picturing you taking these PVC pipes and different fittings and everything and you know, with your team there constructing this LLRV. I know it's been more than 50 years. It's a long time ago. But do you ever look back on that and say, what were we thinking? Why did we think something like this was going to help take us to the moon?
Well, it's interesting. The idea of the lunar lander training vehicle, research vehicle, I think generated back at NASA Langley, where the idea came up, where they needed something, some good training device, not only to help the astronauts basically with training, but to determine what the control powers were going to be required to land in a different environment, because every pound of fuel they carried to the moon, it took, you know, so many thousand pounds of fuel to get them off the Earth. It was a critical thing. So they needed a couple of things. They needed to figure out what was required to really land safely on the moon. And then following that, they needed something to train and expose the astronauts to it before they get up there for the first time. So when they decided to build it, have one constructed by Bell, it was decided it would be flown out at Edwards. And I think the reason was it was Edwards that worked with some of the different rocket fuels and specialty items and things. And they had the great test area. So when they had it built, apparently the contractor was asking for additional money to do the early flights on it, flight development on the vehicle. And NASA was, even though they had a space budget, they were still short in certain areas. And we said, no, ship it out here. We'll put it together and we'll fly it out here. So that was what happened. It come out in parts and pieces. I personally didn't bolt anything to it. I just observed and watched as our fine team of mechanics and engineers put it all together, and there were several test rigs that were built where we were able to put this up on a pedestal, pivoting pedestal, to evaluate the rocket control systems in it and some of the other things even before we flew it. So it was an interesting progress, and it was nice from the piloting standpoint that we were the first ones to do it and to have to do it. And it was built in-house, and it was monitored in-house and flown in-house. So from that standpoint, it was a real fine project.
You know, and I think just here in recent months, we've seen, you know, a U.S.-built rocket take off, head into space, and deliver the astronauts to the International Space Station to much hubbub and attention and celebration. When you watch that and you see the technology that NASA is working with today, can you give us a comparison or a contrast to how different that is from what you were working with in the 1960s?
Well, a little bit. I followed that launch very closely. I had those boys in my thoughts and prayers because that was the first real civilian effort, even though it was government money, NASA development. That was a private company that did all that. And for years, there had been pressure for NASA to move some of this contracting and space work to the private companies. And I don't argue with that. I think that's fine if they're able to do it and they have the level of safety and the monitoring and everything. And so I was real pleased when they made that mission where they were up and got their rendezvous and hooked up with the space station. I know they've made a lot of advances in engineering and technology and automation, and I wonder in the back of my mind, we're going back to the moon hopefully by 2024, but I'm wondering myself now if they're going to really try that completely automatic or if they're going to have the astronauts involved as we did back in the days of the LEM when they first landed on the moon. And although the computers and everything that we had on our initial moon program were pretty weak compared to what's available today, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they don't go completely auto land up there when they go back, but time will tell on that. But I'll keep an eye on that. But I know they've made a lot of advances in computers. We thought we had it all in our day, and we look back and think we had hardly nothing compared to what they're working with today.
Which makes those accomplishments all the more impressive, given what you were working with.
Well, that's right. I think it's like a pyramid or a ladder. One is built upon the other, one step after the other. And further down the road, they'll look back at what's going on today and say, oh, that was old hat. That's old stuff.
Don made a really good point in the documentary when we were talking about the future of NASA and space, like, you know, possibly, you know, back to the moon and to Mars. And in the documentary, the question was put to Don about, you know, how much did he feel he contributed, you know, with his work with the LLRV. And that technology was going to kind of help advance, hopefully, you know, to go to the moon again, which you just talked about, and then they would kind of work from that basis to a newer type of, obviously, you know, 50, 70 years later, to a newer type of vehicle to similar sort of thing.
It's all building blocks. That's right. What comes today is built on what happened yesterday, and what will come tomorrow is what we build on what we do today. So it's just an evolution. And it's sometimes it's pretty damn impressive what's going on in technology.
If there's somebody who's flying, you know, even one of the classified aircraft that none of us know about right now, that's the top of technology. For somebody like that who's used to the best that's out there right now, do you think they would have some challenges trying to saddle into that LLRV and figure out how it works?
There are always going to be challenges. I don't think they would have any question on what existed with the LLRV and what happened with the LLRV. And I don't think we even duplicate it, but they'll build beyond it. You know, if they go to the moon again and it's an automatic landing, they may not even have the capability of a manual landing. I'm not sure what they'll be planning on it. If they're planning on having the astronauts still have that capability, then they're going to need something to replace the LLRV or to be in its, you know, the same type of a motor training. So that'll all determine what the big planners come up with for the mission. Now they're sending things off to Mars in the next couple of months, I guess, from several countries where they're going to land on Mars, and they're going to supposedly retrieve samples and stuff like this, and that's all going to be automatic. So they won't need any LLRV training for that. They'll just need technology to do it automatically.
And I know you and I talked about this before, but what were the biggest challenges for you doing something that no one had ever done before? How much of it was just trying to get a feel for how that would behave, the conditions that those astronauts would be facing, and what the pitfalls they might encounter were? How big a piece to the puzzle was that?
I think the operating or flying the LLRV in that simulation environment, which it could do pretty well. It had a pretty fair simulation of the lunar gravity and no atmosphere and everything. I think that was real important as far as the past missions up there.
You know, since a few things have happened here, we had the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. There was also the film that came out focusing on Neil Armstrong, first man. In all of that, in the publicity around the 50th anniversary and the film and the different things that were said and done, did any of that have an impact on you, how you viewed that overall accomplishment of everyone who worked on it, including your contribution?
It did, on the anniversary of recognition of it and looking back. But as you noted, there was a tremendous pyramid buildup under that final landing on the moon with a lot of people involved. And I'm sure that everyone that was working in that era and part of that program and that responsibility had a feeling at the 50th anniversary. They looked back and they thought, well, we did all right. We did it. And I had that feeling, and I was proud to remember it and happy to remember those days. It's something that I think probably big in a lot of our people's history that were involved with it directly.
It's break time, but there's much more to come with test pilot Don Malik and Cameron Mitchell, the filmmaker who has captured Don's story in a new documentary. Flight Path to NASA is what it's called. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to watch the trailer for the film or link to more information about the project. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting caught up with legendary test pilot Don Malik, whose life story is captured in a just-completed documentary film called Flight Path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. I know I mention our website, hometownheroesradio.com, from time to time, but this is one occasion where you really ought to head over there. You can watch the trailer for this new film produced by Cameron Mitchell, who we have on the line as well. You can also dive into some serious detail by ordering Don's book, The Smell of Kerosene, and you can pull up our original interview with Don from 2018 to hear about his journey from a boy in Pennsylvania who dreamed about flying to a man who flew almost everything imaginable, including something assigned an acronym I'm sure you're going to hear a few more times today, the LLRV, Lunar Lander Research Vehicle. That was a unique and dangerous challenge. Of the five LLRVs produced, three were destroyed in crashes. Don had the courage to fly something that had never been flown before, to work out some of the kinks, and pave the way for what the astronauts who eventually made it to the moon were able to do. We've got the rest of this hour with Don and Cameron Mitchell, the filmmaker.
I've always liked the story, Don. We kind of close in the documentary about what I had asked you. What did your kids and your boys think about you being, a NASA test pilot? Those going, Mach 3 and plus and all that kind of stuff. And do you remember the story when you were tinkering in the garage and one of your boys was there and the neighborhood kids said, "What does your dad do?" You maybe tell
Paul
that story?
That was years ago. I was probably middle of my career then out at NASA, and I was working in a garage and had my work clothes on, and I'm sure it's pretty gritty, and my one son come up with his buddy, and they were talking, and this friend asked my son, he said, "Well, what does your dad work at? What's your dad do?" And my son said, "Oh, he's test pilot out of NASA at Edwards." And this kid looked me up and down, and he said, "He doesn't look like no test pilot to me." And I sort of smiled to myself. I thought, no, I look like a weekend home builder trying to catch up with maintenance around the home. But I didn't fit the image for this young fellow, I guess.
Well, I guess he's not so young anymore, and he can get the whole story if he gets a chance to watch Flight Path to NASA. So, Cameron, what is the latest on that front? When might we have a chance to watch the film that I know has been a real labor of love for you?
Well, currently I'm in the seeking a distribution mode, either by video on demand or, you know, one of the channels. We had a pretty good bite from the Smithsonian Channel. They were interested. So my fingers are still kind of crossed with the Smithsonian Channel. I've been in contact with the Future Legends and other aeronautical type of channel. We're initially going to have our film premiere out at NASA, out at Edwards Air Force Base. And then, like so many things, unfortunately, the pandemic has kind of shut that down, and they were going to pull out the LRV for us and, you know, put out the news press to all LA news stations and things of that sort. So we still have our fingers crossed for that, if we can get past this pandemic thing. And that would be where there would be a premiere of that such. And as you said, currently there's the website is up where your listeners could go. You can give them the website there and view. There's two promo trailers there and a lot of background information about Don's history and a lot of his accomplishments. And so it'd be really fun and interesting for anybody interested in, you know, space travel and aeronautics and, you know, this very interesting man who contributed to, you know, the moon mission and so many other special projects out there at Edwards Air Force Base. And I'll keep people posted through social media and on the website as the project progresses, and hopefully we'll get it out there sooner than later for people can watch the full documentary.
Yeah, and let us know when that's clear, and I'll make sure to pass on that news. And, you know, you shared what first got you interested in telling this story, why you felt you needed to devote some more time to it. Now that you've had so much time, and how, I guess I should ask you that, how long have you been working on this project?
Don, how long has it been? At least about 5 years or so, 4 or 5 years?
I was going to say around four years, I think, when we first started and gathering. And I probably can remember at least 4 or 5 interviews and when it come out recently just to show me the completed show. And I know you've done a lot of legwork and a lot of time on it, so I was pleased to see it when you projected it up here for me on the TV. It was about an hour long, and I thought I was impressed with the way you put it all together, the early years, and some of the pictures you put on there. The quality was impressive on some of the old black and white photographs that you found out of my family album and everything. I just couldn't believe how nice they showed up and came through. So I'm highly impressed, and I'm waiting for it to get on a network or somewhere on TV myself. And I've got a number of cousins and family. Most of my family anymore at my age are cousins. Everybody else has passed on, because in about 3 months I'm going to click over 90 years old in October. They're waiting to see it too.
Along those lines, Paul, it was kind of funny. Kind of got stalled for a little while there with just me doing my other work in television production and things of that sort. And I got a call from Don about a year ago or so. You know, we always just stayed in touch, but he's like, Cameron, when are you going to finish this thing? I'm, you know, I'm getting up there in my years, you know. And so I said, you know, you're right, Don. I better kick it in high gear. And so, you know, I got an editor on full time and, you know, completed all the other interviews that needed to be done, and was just real excited to, that was, you know, with the downtime with the virus, I was able to pretty much commit full time with my editor and just spend, you know, 10, 12 hour days over a course of probably about 2.5, 3 months of my editor and I. And we put it together and are super gratified with where we went with the direction. And another kind of cool thing is, too, is that, you know, we tied Don's life into, you know, the LRV and the moon mission is kind of the highlight of the film. But it really tells a warm and genuine story of Don's passion for flying and the different projects that he was involved with through his years. You flew over, what, 125 different types of helicopters, amphibians, and test planes, and all kinds of things.
Well, I think one of the advantages that I had was when I went into NACA in 1957, even before they converted to NASA, I joined them in June right out of college, and I probably had the minimum requirements for test flying. I had the Navy fighter experience. I had an engineering degree, and I was a one-tour aviator and went right into a flight test job. And NASA had such a variety, not only at Langley, but out here at Edwards, of flying machines. I just could hardly believe it the first summer back in Virginia when I started to fly, and I was checking out multi-engines, checking out in helicopters, and checking out various fighters and V-stalls. And I looked around, and I thought, my world, these guys fly anything that's around here. And then about a year or two later, I was one of those guys flying about anything they came up with. So, and that was a big, interesting part of my career, I think, was a variety of exposure to be able to do that. And not many people were able to do that. If you worked for an aircraft company, you might work with one or two airplanes or something they were building, but that would be it. But with NASA, it was in the space program and had all the supporting missions for the space effort, even though we were still the aeronautics part. So it was a great, great career. No regrets.
I just had another favorite moment from the film that still makes me smile even when I think about it. When I'd asked Don on camera when he first came over to NASA, and Joe Walker, who was the lead test pilot out there at the time, and Joe had asked Don what projects that he wanted to be involved in and would order. And Don told me this story with such childhood excitement, I guess is the best way to explain it, to see Don get so excited after so many years to tell me the programs he wanted to fly. Why don't you tell Paul the three programs that you wanted to get involved with, Don, and how it all kind of came out.
I reported out here in 63. In 1964, NASA come up with some money, and I was able to go through the Air Force Test Pilot School. And when I reported back to the office, when I graduated from the school, Joe Walker was chief pilot, and he called me in. He said, "Don, we have three big priority missions here going on." And he said one of them is the XB-70 and the X-15 and the LLRV. And he said, what's your priority? What would you like flying? I said, well, I want to fly the rocket ship first, the X-15. And if I'm not flying that, I'll fly the B-70. And the third one was the LLRV. And I think that's because I still had that fighter pilot attitude from the Navy. I wanted to go fast. So he said, well, you're going to fly the LLRV with me. So he started me on the LLRV, and then I went on. Unfortunately, I had to go on the B-70 because Joe was killed in a mid-air accident. That's sort of bad part of the job, too. But it was interesting, and I think what it was my Langley experience with helicopters made me an ideal man in the office to go over to the LLRV.
Yeah, it's a great story. And then, unfortunately, you didn't get to fly the X-15, but...
The X-15, when I got here, it was phasing out, was what it was. And I'll tell you, they had what we called a pipeline of pilots who were lined up waiting to fly it. Not all of us got in. I was too late to even get in the pipeline because a few years after I was here, it retired too.
You know, you're in competition because Armstrong was one of the pilots flying the X-15 too, huh?
Neil was on the X-15 before we went into astronauts, huh?
You know, I don't know if I asked you this before, Don, but with all those different planes you flew, and I thought that was one of the best quotes in the trailer, is when you have somebody saying that, you know, Don probably flew more airplanes than most people can actually imagine. But of all those aircraft that you flew, is there one that you think has been overlooked as far as its significance or its value that maybe doesn't get enough attention in light of everything else?
If I had to rate them on national importance, the LLRV would be number one because that moon mission was really a big national effort and it contributed towards that. The B-70 program was a pretty short one. I was involved when at the end of the Air Force program, they had a joint NASA Air Force program on it, and I became involved flying that. But then after several years after the B-70 retired, I flew on our Blackbird program. We had two YF-12 Blackbirds, and we actually, NASA brought those in to continue some of their high-speed high altitude research. The X-15 had been retired, and we flew those two Blackbirds over 9 years, and we had a variety of programs on them. Of course, Lockheed had built them, the Air Force flew them as reconnaissance, and the SRs and everything. But we did a lot of propulsion and structural heating and loads and other programs on them, filling in a lot of sort of squares or empty places in the envelope that hadn't been really looked at or documented. And I feel good about that program, the fact that it went for 9 years and it probably had at least four or five major studies on it with the heating and structures and propulsion and others, and the fact that we were able to operate them over 9 years. And I got pretty comfortable flying the airplane. It was very demanding, but it was very satisfying to fly it and do some of the tests that we were doing on it. So I would put that as number two under the LORV as far as national contributions. And then the B-70 would be third.
Yeah, I've got a couple more questions for both of you, and if there's anything else you want to shoot in there, feel free. Cameron, okay. When I asked you how long you'd worked on it, the other question I wanted to ask you was, in all this time that you've spent with Don, and I'm sure at times you've imagined yourself in his shoes and what it must have been like in those situations, is there one story or anecdote or one realization that you had that just really opened your eyes, blew your mind, you know, raised your eyebrows, really got your attention?
Yeah, actually, too. I mean, of course, back to that LRV, and you'll see some of this amazing footage. It was one of the particular test flights that Armstrong was flying. And, you know, the LRV, you know, could get unstable at times. And there was a time when Armstrong actually had to eject. You got to keep in mind, you know, they were adjusting for the moon's gravity. And I just was so amazed at and impressed, you know, between the engineers, Gene Matranga and all the team and Don, how they were able to fly this awkward, big dragonfly spider looking type of thing and, you know, keep it level and whatever. But when you see the crash that Armstrong actually ejected out of, you know, my heart, you know, went through my stomach when you saw the thing start going crazy and then, you know, shoot up in the air and then explode in the air just as he's ejecting. That kind of still sits with me quite a bit. And another unsung project that Don worked on that I think Don probably had a little bit of fun with was the M2F1, which was the lifting body plane that initially started out. It was towed by a Pontiac with one of the local guys out there that, you know, built the Hemi engine. And they towed it up to 100 miles an hour, and it was built by a hang glider company, and that eventually evolved into the space shuttle. That technology kind of kept evolving and evolving, and then Don got to fly it being towed by a C-47. But there's so many wonderful stories, and both funny and whimsical, of Don needing Chuck Yeager pulling Don out of class. Don thought he was in big trouble with one of the head honchos, and he's, what did I do? Am I in trouble? But Yeager had actually invited him to be towed by the C-47 and get a chance to fly the M2F1. So those two stories really stand out in my mind.
You know, and that last anecdote there makes me think of a question. Again, I'm not sure if I asked you this before, Don. Did you ever receive an offer or an invitation to fly an aircraft that you looked at and said, no way, I'm not getting in that thing? Was there anything that seemed a little too crazy for your test pilot mentality?
Most of the programs I flew, of course, were NASA programs, and one of the confidences I had was the fact that we had so much fine support in engineering and maintenance and everything on our vehicle, so I never was reluctant on any of those. I was invited to fly some other vehicles, but in a way, unless it was somehow sponsored and connected with the government and NASA flying, I wouldn't do it because I just, you know, I didn't know their systems or what they were doing, and I wasn't going to go out and try something like that or take some risk like that when I had such a good envelope where I worked normally, an umbrella for protection. So I did go around NASA and flew different airplanes when I was invited to evaluate them. And I never was exposed to anything that I refused to fly. And not that I was that brave, but maybe it was just my selection. There was a program come down from Ames on a X-wing helicopter. a program similar to others that maybe never made it all the way through to a complete flight where they flew it partially. But this machine was a helicopter with a big X rotor on it, and it was going to take off like a helicopter and transition into forward flight like helicopters do, but then they were going to lock the rotor up, and it was going to serve as a wing, a fixed wing. And I sat in on some of the engineering evaluations on it. That was one program that I questioned the feasibility of it and what they were doing. We were not going to test it at Edwards, but it was going to be brought down to Edwards for the testing by the Ames people. And by the time they got down here to get it ready for testing, they discovered on a test rig down in Florida on this rotor system that when you brought this thing to a stop, the loads were too high and exceeded anything they could handle. And that stopped the program right there as far as trying to do a conversion on this helicopter, taking off, going through forward flight, and locking the rotor system, stopping it completely. That was out the window. And I think they flew it a couple of flights where they took off the runway with the rotor fixed, like a wing. And they were able to fly it like that, just to look at a very short range of it. But that was one program that I was involved with viewing and doing some of the engineering reviews on that I wasn't truly impressed. And when they made that discovery about those loads and everything they were going to face, and they canceled the program, it didn't hurt my feelings a bit.
I guess not. And it makes you wonder how crazy some of the other concepts over the years might have been. Break time again, but I have a few more questions, including what advice Don Malik might have for young people who want to follow in his flight path. Again, that new documentary is Flight Path to NASA. Check out the trailer at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHS Master. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSMaster.com. That's VHSMaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Great to catch up today with Don Malik, one of our country's foremost test pilots. He flew higher and faster than most of us can even imagine. In some cases, he flew aircraft that had never been flown before, risking his life, of course, in that process. You can read about it in his book, The Smell of Kerosene, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. You can also pull up our original interview with Don there, covering his childhood to his days as a Navy fighter pilot, and then that new frontier of experimental aviation. That full trajectory of his life is captured in the new documentary, Flight Path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. You can watch the trailer for the film at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, for that matter. We'll hear more from the filmmaker, Cameron Mitchell, in a moment. But first, Don, I'm curious because I know you encounter young people from time to time, and a lot of them might want to follow in that flight path of yours and do some of the things that you had the opportunity to do. So you have any advice for them?
I do, and it's probably based on my experience and what I went through and preparing for it. I always encourage them to do well in school and apply themselves in school and not to get into the habit of just coasting through and doing the average to make it through, but do the best they can in school. Take all the courses that they can in the technical area and mathematics and science and things like that if they're planning to go into something like the test flying. And that's the biggest thing. I just sort of encourage them, and I said, don't worry about doing it all at once. It'll unfold in front of you, and there'll be one step you'll make, and the next time there'll be another step or Y in the road, and you'll select that, and you just keep building on it, and you'll wind up at your goals, what you're doing. But you have to work and concentrate on each area as you go through it. So I think mostly I encourage them on the school the schoolwork. And I know myself, there were a few courses in school I wasn't that fired up about or interested in. And later on, when it came to some of the writings and putting things together and everything, I wish I'd have paid a little more mind to them. I was more interested in the chemistry and the science and the math than I was in some of the literature and the other things. But just encourage them to do well in their school.
Cameron's documentary here, Flight Path to NASA, is looking through your history, through your past. But as you look ahead, do you have some ideas about what breakthroughs, what accomplishments we may see from the space program, something you hope will happen or you think will happen?
I don't really dream too far ahead. I try to watch what's going on currently and what's planned, and I've been trying to stay up with a little bit on the missions that they're planning now back to the moon by 2024 and the missions 7 months to Mars or whatever it is, and something that's always of interest to me. But to beyond that, I'm not sure. I don't do too much dreaming there. I'm fortunate if I can keep up with what they're doing today.
Well, let's not look too far in the future then, but, you know, your birthday here in October, turning 90 years old, let's say that Cameron's film has an outlet and it's going to be debuted, and like he mentioned, they're able to dust off the LLRV and bring it out there for you. Assuming it's operational, would you climb back in there and buckle up and lift that thing off?
Oh, yeah. You know, when we toured the LLRV with Yule and Cameron, Gene Matranga was a project manager, a real fine NASA gentleman that was on that LLRV, and Gene was with us out in front of the LLRV. I think Yule asked me that, and I told him, I said, I turned to Gene, I said, well, if Gene will get that computer, had about a 400-pound computer on the tail end of it that did all the brain work for the flight control system, I said, if Gene will get that computer up, I'll fly it. And Gene looked at me and shook his head. He said, oh, he said, we'll never get that back up. It was interesting. When I flew that bird, we flew early in the morning, and we liked it because of cooler temperatures. We had more thrust and more lift and lower winds, and I would get a call in the morning from the project engineer. They'd go out there at 2 o'clock in the morning and roll it out and put power on it, and that computer had to run for several hours without a glitch, and they monitored it because it was primary for the flight control system. Well, then they'd call me around 5 o'clock or 5:30, and they'd wake me up, and they'd say, Don, we're looking good. We're looking good. We're going to fly. So I'd get dressed and go out, and we'd fly. If the computer went haywire or had some problems, they wouldn't call me. So then my regular alarm clock would wake me up about 6:30 or something, and I'd go up and go in. But the big thing is it takes so much preparation, and everything had to be just up to snuff to fly it. So, but as far as the physical thing and getting in and flying, so no problem. I tell you another short story here. When I retired in 87, we were retiring our F-104 support airplanes. We used the 104 for chase, for photo chase, and pilot proficiency. And we had one or two of them where we had little test vanes or programs on them, projects on the airplane themselves. But they were getting pretty old, and the Air Force had retired theirs years before. We were having trouble getting spare parts. So we requested some F-18s from the Navy to replace them. And NASA does that a long time. They don't have a lot of money to just buy a fleet. But if the military can support us or bail us airplanes, it works pretty good. But anyway, I went through the ground school up at Navy Lamore for the F-18. I was getting ready to fly it, and the ones that we were sent by the Navy were pretty bad shape. And our maintenance people went through them. They come up to operations. They said, gentlemen, we cannot bring these airplanes up to our safety flight level. They're worn out. Wow. So we sent back the Navy. We said, hey, where do you want us to put these junkers you gave us? We're not able to use them. I think that embarrassed the Navy. Anyway, I retired soon after that. And in the meantime, the Navy came through a year or two later with some F-18s that the Blue Angels had flown for a couple of years, and then they upgraded to newer ones. But their F-18s were pretty nice shape, and they gave them to NASA, loaned them to NASA. And I've been retired 5 years, and I was at the center just for a visit. And do you want to fly the F-18? And I said, yeah. Well, they said the two places in maintenance will be ready in 2 weeks. So I grabbed the handbook, and I went back home, and the thing that impressed me was I started to review the handbook, and what impressed me after 5 years was what I remembered from the Navy school up at Lemoore. Of course, I always had the attitude in an airplane. The more you knew about the airplane and the systems before you get into flight, the more you enjoyed flying it. You weren't flying it looking at something and say, hey, what's going on? You knew what was going on. But anyway, I was impressed, and I remembered that 5 years. I went back, and I had a flight with them, and it was a great flight, and I thought, well, I don't know if I'd have done that. They invited me back after I retired 5 years to do that. I was impressed with that, and the airplane.
Love it.
There you go, Don, holding back the good stories that I didn't get on film.
Well, I guess I should ask you too, Don, because I asked Cameron what he hopes people learn from the film or what they take away from it. You've seen it. It's your life story. What do you hope people see, hear, experience, or take away when they spend the time to watch this?
When I made a couple of other TV programs, I did one on the B-70 with Fitz Fulton for the Great Plains program. It was impressive to me to know that it was projected, it was available. I think I thought more of my family and my contacts and people I knew were able to see more of the details, more of the things that I'd done, where before they just said, well, you're a pilot and that's great, but they got to see more of it. So that's what my feeling is. I'll be happy to see it projected and that people get an idea of that era that I went through and what happened and why it happened. That'll be satisfying to me, but probably more for family, more for relatives and cousins and people like that that are familiar with you in general, and they get a better look-see. So that's a big thing. Just another 15 minutes of fame is what we used to call it out at work down there when they come out and do a movie or something about a project and they're taking pictures or you're doing an interview or something like that. But primarily just to get it documented, and I'm sure the grandchildren will appreciate it and enjoy it too. It'd be something for them to see and point out to their friends that, hey, that was Grandpap.
Yeah, and I know this seems like a cliched question or maybe even melodramatic, but I just imagine that as you watch the documentary, even as you thumb through the pages of your book, or if you're just sitting around the house and remembering, there've got to be times where you say, how did I live through all that? How did I, make it through all those situations? And guys just like you were killed doing the same kind of work. Does that ever make you marvel?
Well, it does. It does. I didn't talk about that too much in the book or anything, but when I went through Navy flight training one fall just before Christmas, I think November or so, down at Corpus Christi, Texas at Cabinets Field, we lost five cadets in about 3 weeks. Were killed, and we weren't that big of an organization. We had about four training squadrons, and two of them were mid-airs, where there were two airplanes lost in each crash. That was four pilots, and one pilot had monoxide poisoning, and he spun in. But that was a pretty big shock, even in flight training, when you're young and you're driving and you're working hard and doing your thing, to see friends like that go. I didn't really know all of them personally. I knew a couple of them, but that sort of set you back. And I recall at that time, there was sort of a nervousness going through the flight training command, and everybody's looking at each other and said, well, maybe we should call Christmas leave a little bit early and get the hell out of here. But the Navy wasn't doing any of that. In the Navy, that was part of the training, so we didn't. And that was sort of a initial exposure to me of the risk level that was involved in flying. Of course, it was training, new people, and it was sort of in missions that were dangerous, like air-to-air rendezvous and things like that. And we had to put that all into the equation. But then later on in my career, several other real close friends that I lost. And I know what you're saying, and there were times that I had some close calls, too, where I thought, well, if it wasn't for Lord and the luck, I wouldn't be here today to do it. And I had a number of those as you'd expect through the flying. There are a number of fine aviators I flew with and everything, and retired and everything, and maybe didn't even make their retirement life too long, head strokes and other things like that that sort of make you wonder about life. So I thank the Lord every day for my health and for what I had in my career and what things I've got through and made it through and everything. And you made a point. There's no reason why I couldn't have been one of those others that didn't make it, but for whatever reason, I did.
Well, and one follow-up on that, too, because on this show, you know, I'm usually talking to guys who served in World War II, and so often, you know, they'll talk about men they served with who passed, and there are over 400,000 who died in World War II, and more than 50,000 in the Korean War, and almost 60,000 in Vietnam, and we know what's happened in the wars since. And it's so easy for us to see that as the price of our freedom. For you and these other test pilots who died in the line of their duty, what's the significance of their sacrifice?
Well, I think it's the same as you'd look at a soldier who gave his life to protect his country. I think you'd look at the fact that the test pilot was doing his best to protect or advance his country and lost his life doing it. So I'd look at it at the same level.
Amen. And, you know, I always end this program with four words that mean a whole lot if you take the time to let them sink in. I always remind our listeners that freedom is not free. And we can say the same about advances in aviation and space exploration. There is a human cost associated with it, which should have something to do with the value we assign to it. We're about out of time, but Cameron, I want to give you the chance to share any closing thoughts.
If you wouldn't mind, Paul, I wouldn't mind closing. Don, this is one of the last things Don said in the documentary. It's taken from a Robert Frost poem, and Don read it so eloquently that really Don and I both discussed using it. It's just one verse of the poem called The Road Not Taken, and Don agreed 100% that it kind of really encapsulated his life, his career, and just kind of everything that he's kind of reiterated in this conversation. And if you don't mind, I can read just, it's the last verse from the film that Don read. Okay, it's called The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Wish Don could be reading this, but here we go. I shall be telling this with a sigh. Somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Yeah. So that kind of brings a tear to my eye every time. Just even just reading this now and then seeing Don read that, telling about his career. So I'd like to close with that.
What a perfect way to wrap up our time today. Cameron Mitchell, Don Malik, thank you so much. Learn more about the documentary project they just finished at hometownheroesradio.com. That will link you to the trailer and lots of relevant information. Thanks for spending this hour with us today on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.